On today's episode of The Good Word, Fred Katz joins us to discuss why the Lakers defense might be a real problem, proposed changes to All-Star Weekend, and of course, we get into the Knicks and Timberwolves and the fallout from the Karl-Anthony Towns, Julius Randle trade. All that and much more coming up right now. Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports and the host of this show. Don't forget, we are wherever you get your podcasts, and most importantly, we are on YouTube. So without much further ado, I bring to you my guest. Today, we are joined by Fred Katz. I call him by a different name. He is a senior NBA writer for The Athletic. He is also the host of Katz and Shoot, a twice-a-week Knicks and NBA podcast. Don't forget to feed into that. Matthew, how you doing?
I'm great. I'm better than all of the confused listeners right now who just listen to you introduce me as Fred and then call me Matthew. So I'm better than them, and I'm better than most other people too. I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm good. I mean, I wonder, when you meet women at bars or stuff like that, do you call yourself Fred or do you call yourself Matthew?
I don't even get to the name. They walk away before the introduction. I walk up, they're like, no, thank you, and just leave. I'm like, I didn't even get to tell you that I go by multiple names. Didn't even get to it.
Look, either way, they're going to hear, the people are going to hear you being called Matthew by the New York Knicks.
There were so many crazy endings to this.
Fred.
Matthew.
I love that sound. We're going to talk some Knicks, of course. We're going to talk some Timberwolves, some All-Star Weekend. But first, of course, we have to start with our obligatory Lakers update. The Lakers got waxed on Saturday night by the Denver Nuggets, who always seem to look like a championship team whenever they play the Lakers. I think it's like 13 or 14. The Nuggets just turned it on after halftime. Even with Russell Westbrook there, like, he had a ball. Nikola Jokic had a ball. The Nuggets were on the second end of a back-to-back, and they had to fly to L.A., and they looked like the fresher team. Fred, I am curious, because the Lakers' point differential before Saturday night, was like a plus 1.5, and they were first or fourth in the West with a 10-5 record, a 10-4 record. And you look at some of the things that they've done right, like Anthony Davis is playing at as high of a level as he can play. LeBron is LeBron. Dalton Connect and Austin Reeves both playing well. Even D'Angelo Russell coming off the bench has taken that in stride. Why isn't it not working to the level of expectations there? Or do you think it's working as designed?
I think right now it is kind of working as designed, to be honest. I mean, look, you look at the wins that they've had, and they haven't really beaten many great teams. They beat Phoenix when Phoenix was playing great and still had Kevin Durant. They beat Sacramento in a close game early in the season. Other than that, they've had a pretty simple stretch of games coming up. I mean, they've had a couple of blowouts that have hurt the point differential. You met the point differential. It's like they've won a lot of close games, and then they got blown out by Denver last night, really in the second half. And then who'd they get blown out? They got blown out by somebody really good earlier in the year, by Cleveland, and I believe by Memphis as well.
Oh, yeah, they got waxed.
So that hurts the point differential to a degree. The starting lineup, when D'Angelo Russell was in it, actually was doing quite well when those guys were on the court. They were plus 10 per 100 possessions, according to Clean the Glass. I'm not necessarily concerned about the Lakers. I'm also not over the top about the Lakers. I think they're probably right around what we thought they were going to be, which is a team that has a chance to be in the play-in tournament in a really, really tough Western Conference. And also, if things go right, AD stays healthy, LeBron stays healthy, has a chance to be in that top six too. I wouldn't put them top three in the West. I probably wouldn't put them top four in the West with the way a lot of those other teams are playing. And I don't take that much away from the second half of the Denver game last night, because Denver just seems to have their number. That team was not playing very well lately either. It's been like Jokic and everything else. And you want to talk about a team that has an issue that is glaring, and it's just, when Jokic is on the floor, they're unbelievable. And when Jokic is off the floor, they get decimated. And that's been true every year. But it's a whole other degree this year. So they got killed with Jokic on the court yesterday. And even in the first half of that game, right? Jokic comes out of that game. Lakers go on a 19-7 run.
Yeah.
And it's like, you get killed when Jokic is on the floor. It's like, well, stuff, that stuff just happens. Like, he's a 3-time MVP who is playing at a level to where he'd be a unanimous 4-time MVP if the season ended today. I don't think that loss is that big of a deal. I just kind of, it's not like after the hot start, I looked at them and was like, damn, this team is way better than we thought. I think it's probably in that 45, 48, 49 win range.
49 seems like a real high watermark for them. I'll
49 seems high. 49 seems high. Maybe 45, 47, maybe.
I'll tell you this. J.J. Redick, who I think is probably a really good coach, right? He seems to be doing the right things. He seems to be emphasizing, you know, spreading the floor, more threes, more modern game, all this other type of stuff. Emphasizing Anthony Davis, who actually can't do anything against Nikola Jokic. That's got to be the most deflating thing possible, is that you can literally kill everybody else except this dude. But I tell you this, Fred, I don't know if J.J. Redick is long for this whole life, because I've only seen one other coach in my years of watching basketball and hearing the stories and everything else. I've only seen one coach take losses, regular season losses, this damn hard. And that was Doug Collins. And Doug Collins was the master. For those who only know him as a TV guy or know him when he played and everything else, Doug Collins is a genius of a basketball mind. He's a genius of a motivator. But baby, let me tell you, he wears every loss all the time. And if he's wearing it, that means he's going to extract it from himself and put it on the guys. And that seems like a recipe for someone who's going to burn himself out quickly. That's what it looks like. He looks like J.J. Redick to me.
That might be the case. I mean, we've seen it's not just the losses, it's struggles in general, right? Like there was that viral clip of D'Angelo Russell taking a bad off the dribble fadeaway from the corner, and you see J.J., he wasn't even sitting down at the time. He went to his seat so that he could assault the seat, right? He grabs the bottom of the seat and jumps up and down and slams it into the floor. And it was like so frustrated. And that was the same game where he ends up benching Russell.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know. Like, I think sometimes we don't give coaches the same courtesy that we give players, which is when Steph Castle has a bad turnover in crunch time against the Warriors last night, which, by the way, he makes up with an incredible steal on the next play. Mm-hmm. But when Steph Castle makes a turnover, we say, social rookie learning the ways of the league. And J.J. Redick's a rookie learning the ways of the league, too. I know he played for a long time. I know he's been a strong voice in media for a long time. But coaches progress, and they learn stuff, and they learn from their mistakes, and they learn from their demeanor. And they edit things. And some things are just inherent to who they are, and they never change. And some things are able to be improved. And I don't think we can really know which are the things that are inherent to who they are and which are the things that can be modified until we kind of see more of it. So quite honestly, I'm not really at the point where I'm willing to take any grand takeaways away from Redick right now. For me, the thing that concerns me the most with the Lakers is, like, you mentioned all the stuff that's going well. AD having a great year, LeBron being LeBron, even though he's almost 40, Dalton Connect hitting every single three, and mm-hmm. Austin Reeves having some nice moments, and D'Angelo Russell having some nice moments off the bench, and all of that. All that's on the scoring end. The issue for them right now is they are not as good of a defensive team as they should have been. Like, the way I said they're right, I think they're right about the quality of the team that I thought they were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But the way I framed it wrong. I should have said they're about the quality of the team that I thought they would be in a different manner than I expected them to get to that quality. Where they're a better offensive team than I thought. Anthony Davis has been unbelievable this season.
Mm-hmm.
He has just been at a whole other level. Dalton Connect has been great, and people there were really excited about him from the second that they drafted him. But defensively, they're getting scoured. They're, I think, 26 in points allowed per possession right now. And they're top five offense, but that's why that point differential keeps falling down. They keep giving up all those damn points. And defensively, their stuff,
they don't get back on defense. Like, that might be the number one thing. When they turn the ball over, you can see it's just automatic 3-on-1s, 4-on-1s. And some of the main culprits are some of these guys who score a lot of points on an everyday basis.
Totally. And you know what? the issues aren't just fast breaks. Like, a lot of people have pointed out the transition defense, but the problem is what the transition defense is leading to is mismatches on the other end. Like, you look at them, they're 23rd in defensive rebound rate, right? But part of the reason they're 23rd in defensive rebound rate is because when everybody doesn't hustle back and isn't able to pick up their man, and you've got Anthony Davis guarding on the perimeter, and Anthony Davis is responsible for a disproportionate amount of your defensive rebounding, but he's got to go out and guard the perimeter because everybody got matched up on the wrong guy because you didn't get back, you're going to have a harder time rebounding the basketball in that scenario. And I think those sorts of things will have trickle-down effects on the defense. And I'm not saying necessarily that this team should be elite defensively,
right?
But a team with Anthony Davis on it is just not built. This team is not built to be 26th in points allowed per possession. And I don't think it'll end up that low in defense. But, you know, a stretch of 16 games where they're that low, I have to imagine that's something that is probably ticking off J.J. Redick too.
Well, he always comes across like, I know the answers. I know what the problem is, but he doesn't actually say it. Maybe it's because he can't say it. And if that's the case, okay, fine, so be it. I feel like they have problems against big teams. They have problems against athletic teams, as we got to see against the Orlando Magic. Like, Orlando walked them down minus Paolo Banchero. Like, you're going to have problems with teams that fit a certain profile more than it is, oh, we got problems with this type of player. And the NBA is becoming more and more, when you look at the standings, oh, young and athletic. Oh, you're moving well. Oh, it's not just switching and being able to shoot. It's just an overall quickness and pace, and not pace in terms of statistics, but pace in terms of how we are actually getting into our offense, how we are actually getting into actions. You're starting to see a lot of that. But that's enough for the Lakers, because that ain't really what I brought Matthew here for. Matt.
Yeah, I've never heard you drop Matt.
I'm sorry.
Never heard that.
It's a lot of Matts in our building. I'll just say that. It's a lot of Matts. I've been saying Matt a lot for the past couple of weeks. All right? Just sorry about that. Now, All-Star Weekend is not yet approaching, but of course we've been hearing about the different potential modifications to the All-Star game, to revamp the All-Star game. And the latest iteration, which I think is a cockamamie farce. Okay, let me say that. That's like influencing the jury. I don't care. I'm influencing the jury. It's a cockamamie farce. But here's the latest one. Per your former teammate, Shams Charania of ESPN, a playground style with four rosters. The four teams would consist of three All-Star like teams of eight players each. And the fourth team would be the winner of the Rising Stars Challenge from Friday night or Saturday night, whenever the hell it is. And you know how it goes, playground style. One against three, two against four, winner places winner, and then you have some type of, ultimate winner. If the players don't give a damn about a regular game, they're not going to care about a playground game. And unfortunately, we can't solve that problem. It's not for us to solve, per se. Like, the format, I don't think Fred is going to change it. I just think if the players don't care, then nothing matters.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I don't care. Everyone has such strong reactions. I've been on a text thread with former Yahoo great Michael Lee, who's just the best and one of the best basketball writers who's ever done.
Love
the thing.
Him.
He's the best. And Michael and I have been in a debate via text message for like five consecutive days. He feels so passionately about what a terrible idea this is and how they're ruining the All-Star game. And I hope that I'm not stringing his ideas out into the public to lead to his extraordinary social demise. And I'm just like, you can't make me care. I just don't care. I think the last couple of years broke me to a degree where I'm like, the All-Star game was so broken that there's no fix that could make me think that it won't continue to be broken. And it was so broken that it broke me when it comes to the All-Star game. I just don't care. I think the All-Star game is an anachronism, honestly. Anachronism. I think it's an anachronism. There we go. I think it's an anachronism. I think it is something that made sense 50 years ago when League Pass didn't exist, when you got to see, 50 years ago was 1973, when you got to see 1974, when you got Wilt Chamberlain twice a year coming into your city and you could see him then, when games often weren't televised, and when the All-Star game was your opportunity to see these great players play against each other and for them to show out on the national stage. Now there's a nationally televised game every day. Everyone's got League Pass. Everyone who doesn't have League Pass can illegally stream all their crap. It's nothing. If somebody wants to see Giannis, they can see Giannis play 82 times a year if they want to. And nobody cares about it. I think part of the pride in the All-Star game back in the day was everyone in the country is watching me for the only time of the year. And so I'm going to show up. Now everyone's like, I don't care. I get watched every single night. It means nothing to me. I also think there's probably a lessening with players today of caring about the greater good of the game than there used mm-hmm. to be. Whereas players mm-hmm. back in the day cared more mm-hmm. about growing the game. And players today, I think, feel like, well, the game has been grown now. This is it. It's been grown. We're making so much money. I'm worrying about my own stuff. I'm not worrying about growing the game. And I think that's something that is part of it too, where players kind of felt like they were part of a greater thing. And I don't know how you recover that. Like, I don't know how you pay somebody $55 million a year and then are like, no, you got to do the greater good for everybody. It's like, no, I'm making $55 million a year. What are you talking about? I'm making more than you, commissioner. What are you talking about? So I don't know how you recover that. I don't think a pickup format will recover that. But I also don't care. It doesn't offend me. It doesn't upset me because I didn't care before and I don't really care now. This is not exactly an advertisement for the All-Star game.
It offends me. You can say I'm a historian and I live in the crates and all sort of type of stuff. You're absolutely right. I grew up watching the All-Star game. I think the thing that you pointed to, one of the things that you pointed to was a concern of mine about the regular season is that 82 games, you're going to lose like the ability to make a single game special in a way that you can make an NFL game special because there's just fewer inventory. And now with the new television partners, which I think is a great thing overall, you're going to have access to more regular season games on all these different platforms. Granted, it's going to cost you to get the Peacock. It's going to cost you to get the Amazon if you don't have it. All this other type of stuff. Let's just assume that you do. The second point that you made is the one that I want to drill down on because I think it's really, really important. The league was built by and large on players who knew they were playing for something bigger than themselves. And they knew that they were not going to be the guys to be able to cash in on the growth of it. And now it feels like en masse. And I'm not pointing to one player or another. I'll just say this. In 2020, in the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of Kobe Bryant's death of January in 2020. And we had the All-Star game in Chicago. And that was the first year of the format with the charities and everything else. That was one of the greatest All-Star games and finishes that we had seen because it was competitive and people cared. And Kyle Lowry and Chris Paul went into those locker rooms beforehand and told guys, we are going to play hard. If nothing else, we're going to play hard. For whatever reason, that spirit has gotten lost. And maybe, and you don't want to have a franchise or an NBA legend pass away weeks before the All-Star game to get you to say, okay, we're going to give a damn now. You know what I mean? Like, they're capable of doing it. My problem is just in general is that the game has given so much to them and that the game that they've entered has been built on the backs of players who never received the rewards, who we tell all the time, stop hating, stop being jealous about the money that these guys are getting. When are they going to give to the game? When are they going to grow the game? All we hear is all the obligations that they have. And, you know, you got to spread All-Star Weekend out even more because of the corporate stuff. If you spread All-Star Weekend out even more, it's going to be more corporate obligations. It's not going to change anything. You already got a long break. Like, guys just have to, I think this points to maybe a greater societal problem that we don't have to address here. People just think about themselves and they don't think about the world that's going on beyond them. Even though we have far more access to what the world looks like outside of our own silos, it seems like the players and just the culture of the world, the culture of sort of sport or whatever you want to say, pop culture, is just that think about me and not about we. And I don't know. You're right. I don't know how that changes anything. I don't know if Steph Curry and Klay Thompson against Caitlin Clark and Sabrina Ionescu, if that 3-point thing happens, that helps the WNBA. I don't know if that helps the NBA. I don't know if that helps All-Star Weekend at all. Or there was a meeting that we had, like a few writers were invited to a few years ago at All-Star. And some of the players on the Players Association were saying, well, if you paid us more, we would do more stuff on All-Star Saturday night. And I'm not getting in anybody's pockets, but I'm like, hey, man, come on. Like, everything has a price. Like, nothing is about giving back to the game. Everything has to be, well, if you got to pay us more because those guys back then were getting paid more. Maybe, but it wasn't commensurate to the salary that they weren't getting to begin with. Like, that's the thing that offends me, Fred.
I get that. And to be clear, it's not every player. It's not every player. I maintain.
I'm saying as a pejorative. I'm not saying every single guy. Like, when you have Barack Obama coming into your locker room before the All-Star game last year, and you go put out that piss poor performance, I mean, A, maybe that should have been a signal that people are not as influential as we like to think that they are. But that's a discussion for another day. My bad. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
If Barack Obama were capable of getting NBA players to play super hard during the All-Star game, then somebody should just hire him as a head coach. Not everybody can do that. I will say the thing that happened in 2020 that made everybody play hard, and this is a thing that I've maintained and it'll never happen, but there should be a Kyle Lowry Memorial All-Star on each team. The reason that everybody played hard was because Kyle Lowry, and guys didn't play really hard for the first three quarters. It was just the fourth quarter where it got intense. Mm-hmm. And what happened was Kyle Lowry started trying to take charges on everybody in a pickup game. And then everybody was like, screw this dude. I'm going at it. And anyone who's ever played pickup knows that when somebody tries to take a charge on like the blacktop, you want to punch that dude in the face and you start going really hard. And Kyle Lowry took two charges in the fourth quarter of the All-Star game, which I don't even have to look up to know that that's a record. There's no way anyone's taken two charges in the fourth quarter of the All-Star game. And if you just have like a Kyle Lowry Memorial All-Star position, one on each team, and one is Kyle Lowry or a Kyle Lowry-esque player, and one is Marcus Smart, and they have to be on the court at all times, and their only job is they have to scrap like crazy and try to take charges on everybody, then people are going to play hard. But the issue is you don't have people approaching the All-Star game with that mentality. And you know what? It's kind of fine. The All-Star game is a cash cow for them. It is a cash cow for bringing in. I think it's more for the international audience than it is for the national audience at this point. It's certainly more for the international media than it is for the national media. And you have to look at media as a conduit to the fan base. And I think it's a lot for the international audience, probably more so in terms of just like, in terms of growth. Like, they're not growing the game domestically with the All-Star game, but I think they look at it as a possible way to grow it internationally with the All-Star game. And I think we just have to accept it as like, it's probably never going to go back to anything that was great. Maybe you'll have one standalone year where something happens like 2020 and you have a good finish for whatever random reason. But for the most part, it's just going to be whatever it is. And when there are good dunkers, we'll get a good dunk contest. And when there are good 3-point shooters, we'll get a good 3-point contest. And that'll be it. I will say the one thing that I appreciate with the NBA is I appreciate them not just digging into their spot in the box and being like, nope, we're going to do it the same way all the time. And some of their ideas are totally out there. And I'm like, this is wild. But I appreciate the mentality of being like, no, this isn't working. So we're just going to shake it up because why the hell not? It wasn't working previously. If this doesn't work, what's the downside? So I appreciate them approaching that with that mentality as opposed to like, and in a harmless sort of way. They're not doing it like baseball did where they're like home court advantage, the team that wins or something. And in a harmless sort of way that's not going to affect the season. I think the NBA is good with that sort of innovative stuff in general. Like I never liked the NBA Cup until I saw it. And then I was like, okay, this is fun. I'm into it, and its intended purpose is to get guys to play harder, and they're playing harder. So this works. I think they just have to find – I do think it is an absolute problem for the league that every single change that they make that has any kind of significance has the motivation of how can we get the players to play harder. I do think that's a problem. because no other league seems to have that problem. The NBA, like I covered the Washington Wizards, and Scott Brooks used to go out there to the podium after games and be like, we have a try-hard problem. We have a try-hard problem. And I'd be like, how do you have a try-hard problem, Scott? And he'd be like, I don't know, but nobody tries hard. And he would just literally say that. After games, 2018-19 Wizards, when they just really did have a try-hard problem, and that team did not play hard at all. And the fact, like, a whole league can't have a try-hard problem. And that, to me, is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, issue facing the NBA right now, is that every single change that they make seems to be motivated behind the question of how can we get these guys to play hard in a way that it helps the league's growth and helps the league, period. That's an issue. It's an issue. You shouldn't have that problem.
You can't say basketball never stops when you will play and try harder when you're playing at Lifetime Fitness than you will at a sanctioned All-Star game where you actually have medical insurance. We'll be right back to talk about Knicks and Timberwolves with Fred Katz here on The Good Word. Welcome back to The Good Word here with Fred Katz of The Athletic. Fred, the Minnesota Timberwolves and New York Knicks made a trade on the eve of training camp. Karl Towns for Julius Randle and Dante DiVincenzo, right? Shockingly, both teams have gotten worse on the defensive end for it. Both teams hovering around 500. The Knicks, of course, are doing a little bit better because the Eastern Conference is trickety trash right now. They have the third best point differential, which we talked about a little bit earlier with the Lakers. But a defense under Tom Thibodeau, dropping to 21st in defensive rating by merely bringing in Karl Anthony Towns as your center, who is doing really good work on offense and is a sieve on defense.
I would say it's more than just Towns, to be honest.
Oh, Mikal Bridges has not been great either.
They lost Isaiah Hartenstein, who had an incredible defensive season last year. Really a wonderful defensive season. Held them up from a rim protection standpoint, from running their coverages to a T. He was just great defensively. He was a great rebounder on both sides of the ball. He was a great passer and was tremendously important for them, and they did not want to lose him. I mean, they offered him everything that they were allowed to offer him by the collective bargaining agreement and just got beat out on the offer because the CBA rules said they could not offer more than they offered, and he got more from Oklahoma City and went there. And I think that kind of started a chain where they started to get worse. You know, Mitchell Robinson ends up getting hurt. He's their rim protector, and they were hopeful he'd be back by the start of the season. His rehab ends up being slower than they expected, coming back from an ankle injury, and now he's going to be out until at least December. I imagine it'll be later than that. I imagine it'll be January or maybe even later than that. I'm not really ready to put a timeline on it, to be honest. Yeah. And so you're missing kind of your two rim protectors. And when you go into the year, they end up making this trade. Also, Precious Achiuwa out, who is on and off offensively, isn't a shooter, can have some crazy turnovers, but that dude guards. He really guards. He plays crazy hard in the defensive end. He's athletic as hell, long arms. You could switch with him. He flies all over the floor. Tibbs loves him. Like, that guy guards. He will make your defense better, no question. And they go into this year after making the Towns trade with, like, okay, you've got a problem at the top with Jalen Brunson, who's a below average defender. You got a problem at the bottom with Karl Anthony Towns at the five, who's a below average defender. However, we're going to insulate those two guys with elite wing defense, with Josh Hart, with OG Anunoby, with Mikal Bridges. And they're assuming that wing trio will be the best defensive wing trio in the league. And I think that's a good assumption. I think, honestly, pretty much everybody agreed that was the best defensive wing trio in the league coming into this year. OG Anunoby has held up his part. He is having an incredible defensive season.
He is so good.
He has been, I can't imagine how you could want more from what he's done. He signed the massive contract this summer to come back to the Knicks and has been worth every penny so far. I can't imagine what you would want more from OG Anunoby on either side of the ball than what he's done. Josh Hart is having the best season of his career. He has been good defensively, not great defensively. He's had some schematic problems, but he has been good defensively. he's weird. Every once in a while, he'll go under a screen when he's not supposed to. He'll go over a screen when he's supposed to go under. But for the most part, he's done a good job. He fights hard, and obviously he's going to make every single energy play. The dude is 6'4", and he's averaging like 9.5 rebounds a game. He's having the best season of his career, for sure. And then you go to Bridges, who has been guarding the point of attack more than anybody, and he wasn't the all-world defender in Brooklyn that he was in Phoenix. And I think a lot of people took on the assumption that, okay, well, he has a much bigger offensive burden in Brooklyn. And once you remove that offensive burden and you bring it down closer to something where it's in Phoenix, or you bring it down enough to where you can tell him, you know what? You just go all out on defense and don't worry about the other stuff. Just hit some threes, have some cuts, and do whatever, and you'll be good to go. And that's not what's happened. He has, I would say, by what the expectations were for him, has struggled defensively. He's letting up on a lot of screens. He's not getting around a lot of other screens. The Knicks, one of their biggest problems is their point of attack defense right now. And it's been an issue with Bridges out there. And you look at the starting lineup, like, this team is not deep, especially not with the injuries they have.
Mm-hmm.
Although they've got some guys off the bench, like Cameron Payne's been good for them off the bench. Deuce McBride's been obviously good for them off the bench, and he's a good sixth man. But this team is not supposed to win off of depth. This team is supposed to win because the starting five is supposed to annihilate other teams. And you look at the starting five, and they are just, they're killing offensively. They're scoring against anybody. And this team right now is so great offensively. But they're only plus 3.5 per 100 possessions, that starting five, which is not even close to what you want in terms of dominant. And the reason why is because they're giving up almost 120 points per 100 possessions. And that is way too high of a number. And they are getting beaten everything in transition, in pick and rolls, on cuts. They're miscommunicating. Defensively, they're just not the same. And I think they can get better. And I think we could talk about a million different places where it starts. But right now, defensively, they're just not at the place they need to be in order to, I think, even make a conference finals run.
Well, I don't think anybody can be really in a confident conversation to say we're going to be in the conference finals besides Cleveland and Boston right now in the Eastern Conference, because nobody's good. I think Orlando, not that we're completely zooming out, but Orlando, when Paolo Banchero comes back, like, they have a very solid foundation. Like, they build the way that I suppose you want a team in today's NBA to build. You're going to build through the draft. You're going to sign a couple of your guys to big money extensions, and hopefully you have enough cap space to sign a KCP. The way that the Knicks have done this, everybody that they've acquired, it's been nothing homegrown. There's no problem with that per se, but it does lend to saying, okay, we got to sacrifice, we got to give up a lot in the way of depth and draft picks and overpaying established players, as opposed to sort of having the, oh, you're on a rookie scale deal, suppressing your own value because you are in our building, as opposed to being already a veteran into it. Mikal Bridges is such an interesting case to me. You brought up the fact that he is, you know, you're looking at it, oh, well, your usage was up in Brooklyn. Now you're going to scale it back and focus more on defense. A lot of times when defensive players become offensive players, they don't really go back to saying, okay, I'm just going to defend now. When dudes get a taste of that drug called scoring, baby, they want to score. I have no problem with that. I think that is human nature. But I think especially when you add someone like Karl Towns, and you know what Karl Towns is there to do. He is there to spread the floor for Jalen Brunson. He is there to be pretty much the biggest safety valve, 7-foot safety valve on a 1-5 screen and roll, or any level of screen roll. And offensively, he has been fantastic. At the rim, not so much. And I don't know if Mitchell Robinson is the answer. I don't know if they have to, like, they feel pretty landlocked as far as what they can do personnel-wise moving forward. You feel like a lot of these teams, because of the new CBA, Fred, a lot of these teams are landlocked in what type of moves they can make. So it's going to have to be a lot of internal improvement and growth, kind of what you're seeing in Milwaukee. But they had such a drastic place to come back from that even just getting back to water being level, I'm supposed to give them applause. It's a different thing for the Knicks because we're expecting so much from them, and Tibbs is such a great defensive coach. Now I want to go to the more interesting one, Matthew. I keep switching back and forth from calling you Fred and calling you Matthew. People will get it. This is not a three-man weave. Fred is just Harvey Dent and Two-Face at the same time. The Minnesota Timberwolves, a team that
One's the evil one? Which one is the evil one here?
Matthew's the evil one.
That makes sense.
Matthew's the evil one. Name yourself that, then that's the evil one. Right?
But my parents named me Matthew. My third grade teacher named me Fred.
Yeah,
you've reversed it.
That's what it was. Yeah, Matthew is the
Matthew's pure of heart.
Matthew's pure of heart.
Fred's just here to crap on the All-Star game.
You didn't crap as much, Fred. You were kind of kind, and you were even a little more kind to the Knicks than I wanted you to be. I want to see if you're kind to the Timberwolves.
Offensively, the Knicks are ridiculous.
Oh, they're great. They're great.
They are unbelievable offensively, and I'm just not at a point where I'm like gonna tear everything down that they're doing yet, because they've had moments where offensively it's like, damn, they look so good. With Bridges, I am weirded out by the Bridges season. You know the last time that Bridges drew a shooting foul inside the three-point arc?
When?
3 weeks ago.
Oh, so he's not going to... Oh, yes.
He's gone 10 consecutive games without drawing a foul inside the three-point arc. And that foul that he drew 3 weeks ago was November 4th against Houston. It was off of like an alley-oop where Dylan Brooks was just like, oh, I got to break this up, and lightly touched Bridges in the paint. And before that, the last one before that, was October 25th, the second game of the season against Indiana.
Wow.
He's drawn 3 2-point shooting fouls this season.
Look, and one of them doesn't really count, because Dylan Brooks is the kid that bites you in the third grade and you say, hey guys, we got to call Dylan's parents again. He just bit the lunch lady. Like, that's Dylan Brooks. That doesn't really, really count, right?
It's been such a strange season for Bridges. He's hitting like 45% of his corner threes and like 15% of his above the break threes. And it's just been
He changed his shooting form, which is never like a positive thing when you see guys change it.
His numbers from the mid-range are outrageous. But the problem is, your foul rate from the mid-range is generally going to be somewhere around zero. So you're just not going to draw fouls on those plays. So when he gets into the paint and then he ends up fading away from 8 feet instead of going all the way to the rim.
Contact, yeah.
Exactly. It's like he's shooting, you know, 50-some-odd% on that shot, which you can say, oh, it's a good shot. But at some point, if that number comes down, you're just not insulating yourself with anything else if your shot is off. Like, once you have a game like he did against Utah where he was missing shots, but you're not doing anything else, now all of a sudden it's like you don't have other ways to help the team. Whereas, say, Karl Anthony Towns, because of the types of shots that he takes, where he can get to the line and he's going to drive and he's going to create for others. Bridges hasn't really been creating threes. Like, Towns is having a wonderful passing season. He's been really good for them passing on the block.
Excellent. He's not having a great passing season. I think Towns is a really good passer that I don't think we paid that much attention to because of all the other things in Minnesota. He is a wonderfully dynamic offensive player. You can argue that the Timberwolves are having a difficult time offensively adjusting to life without Karl Anthony Towns, right?
Yes.
They're 8-8. This Julius Randle, Rudy Gobert tandem, it's almost like, not like marriage counselor, Fred, but it's almost like Julius Randle sees Rudy Gobert sealing, was it Scottie Barnes, right? Was the other night against Toronto, hit Scottie Barnes sealed and like buried him underneath the rim. Do you think he threw in the ball? Of course he didn't throw in the ball. Why? Because he's seen Rudy Gobert fumble passes all the time. And Rudy, as Rudy is wont to do, Rudy was out here pouting. Okay. Now, on the other end of it, if you're Rudy Gobert and you're looking at Julius Randle not covering his end defensively, like the Rudy Gobert, Karl Towns, as crazy as it sounds, those two were really good per 100 possessions last year. This year, Gobert and Randle, not bad. They're actually good. They're just not as good as Towns. And I think that's a lot to do with Gobert's effect on defense And when Rudy feels like, hey, I got a cover for you on defense and you're not throwing me the ball when I'm open, you're going to have some friction. And I saw it a little bit in that game against the Celtics where Ant was going at, not Ant going at Julius Randle. He was saying, hey, man, this is where you are supposed to be. It was like two or three plays in a row when they were trying to make their comeback against the Celtics, a team you cannot make mistakes against. And you're seeing the slippage. They lost to Portland twice. They lost to the Spurs. They lost to Toronto. They lost to the Celtics. No shame in losing to the Celtics. But when you're 8-8, you got to start evaluating every single level of what you've got going, especially with Dante not adjusting well. Mike Conley is old. That defense is going from first to 11th. Like, we've got some issues there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, who would have thought that two teams who completely flipped their identities in the middle, after training camp even started,
mm-hmm.
who would have thought that they would have identity problems?
Shocker.
Going into the year?
Shocker.
Who would have guessed it? I will say, I mean, they're still almost plus seven with Randle and Gobert on the court together. That's pretty good.
I thought they were plus five.
I think cleaning the glass has them at around plus seven for 100 possessions, which is pretty good.
Okay.
Randall's making shots. He has not been great on the boards this year, but he's making shots. Anthony Edwards is putting up a ridiculous amount of threes. With them, I look at a couple of things where I'm like, okay, I think I didn't expect this. Number one is Dante DiVincenzo just missing freaking shots. And they put him in the starting lineup against Boston on Sunday. Mm-hmm. I thought they lost to Boston by two. I thought they played a good game in that game.
Yeah.
I thought they were good defensively. I think they're going to start to give Nikhil Alexander-Walker some more play. He started a couple of games with Conley out with the toe injury now.
They played Rob Dillingham a lot against Boston. He seemed to turn it up a little bit, especially in the second half.
He just defensively is like, you want to talk about defense. It's like there's a play in that Boston game where Jason Tatum gets the ball.
He just ran away from him.
On the right wing, and Dillingham is on him, and Lord knows why, just runs away from him. And it's like, he's a rookie. That's why. I say Lord knows why, but the reason why is because he's a rookie, and I'm not putting him on a poster for being a rookie. It's just like stuff like that's going to happen. He's barely played. He had like 20 points all season coming into this game, and he drops like 14 and 17 minutes mm-hmm. in this game and hit some big threes and was really good in the second half. But that's just what happens in terms of growing pains and getting comfortable. With this team, though, I thought Dante DiVincenzo hitting shots was going to be a given. I still kind of think he's going to be hitting shots. And they put him in the starting lineup, and he actually went 3-for-6 from three in this game, which was one of his better shooting games of the season, and he's still putting them up, and he's really confident, and that dude does not give a crap what he shot in the previous game. But that he had a great year last year, and that was not just like a throw-in to the Karl Anthony Towns
trade. No, he was a critical part of that trade. Yeah,
he was the closing piece. It was like mm-hmm. Minnesota wasn't doing that deal unless they got DiVincenzo. That was why they were doing the deal. Can we get DiVincenzo out of this deal? And the fact that he has struggled, the fact that he struggled to find a role, they've used him a little bit more as a creator than the Knicks did. Even when the Knicks were really injured, they tried him out at point guard at times. I mean, you know, he basically started at the point on Sunday against Boston. I do think the shot will come, but I think that offense could use his shooting, and I think that offense needs organization. Like, you look at what happened with them last year. They make a run to the conference. That was a conference finals team last year. And mm-hmm. you look at them throughout the season, and when they didn't have Mike Conley, the whole through line was, you know, this team could use an adult in the room. Where is Mike mm-hmm. Conley? Mm-hmm. This team just needs an adult in the room. That's when they have the careless turnovers, and that's when Gobert ends up cutting back into the paint while Ant is driving, and they're like, oh no, and they run into each other, and you know, that brings over his health defender, and it makes a really difficult drive for Ant. And that's when all that stuff happens. Mm-hmm. Mike Conley is the adult in the room for them, and he has been for a while. And you look at the numbers, and the numbers will absolutely reflect that. And this year, Mike Conley is shooting like 32%, shooting like 28% on twos. And he's out with the toe injury now. It doesn't sound like, based on the reporting from my colleague, John Krasinski, that it's very serious long-term. But what they could use is just they don't need prime all-star Mike Conley. What they could use is just like good enough to justify continuing to play him, Mike Conley. That's what they could use. And I don't know if they're going to get that, because at some point, Father Time catches up to every one of us. Mike Conley has had a fantastic, really long career, and maybe it's catching up to him. He's also a really smart, really clever player who understands how to play the game. And like, you still look at the numbers and it's like, when Mike Conley is on the court, they shoot way better. When Mike Conley is on the court, their shot profile is way better. When Mike Conley's on the court, I believe their turnover rate is down. Like, you look at all these things and it's like, this team is better when Mike Conley is out there. Mm-hmm. And if it could be a version of Mike Conley who's just shooting like 45% on twos and 35% on threes, just enough to keep him on the floor, those aren't extraordinary numbers, then I think you have your organizer and they will start to look a little bit better. But it was the same thing last year, and that was a conference final team. Like, Mike Conley is underratedly important to the success of this team, and they put a large burden on him. And when he is struggling to the degree that he has struggled out of the gate this year, I think you're going to see that come through in the rest of the roster also.
Yeah, I think he's 36, and I think because LeBron and KD and Steph have changed what we think of players who are aging, that we don't think of players aging, and they do. And at some point, the wheels fall off. I'm not saying that the wheels fall off for him, but there is an adjustment period that you have to adjust to, and teams have to adjust to the ages of their players to ensure that they are not overtaxed. And sometimes guys got to grow up too. Like, you cannot put everything on Mike Conley being the adult in the room, because he's the adult in the room. At some point, some of these other dudes have to grow up too. And that's where we're going to leave things. And when we come back, we're going to take our last break here. We're going to talk about lottery watching. Who's looking to capture the flag? Welcome back to The Good Word. It's time for The Last Word here with Fred Katz of The Athletic. Fred, we thought this year was going to be an epic race to the bottom because of Cooper Flag, right? When we saw him at USA in Las Vegas playing with the U.S. Olympic team, and we got to see the video, and we're like, look at this nice, young, strapping athlete who has qualities that make an NBA superstar. I thought for sure the Utah Jazz were going to rue the day that they signed Lauri Markkanen to that extension on like August 5th or something like that, which makes him ineligible to be traded by the trade deadline. Guess what, y'all? They have raced themselves to the bottom of the Western standings. They are going to put themselves in the Cooper Flag sweepstakes, whether they want to or not. I did not expect the teams to be at the bottom. I expected the Wizards to be there. I'm sure you did too. I did not expect the Pelicans to be one of the league's worst teams. I did not expect the Philadelphia 76ers to go back and do the process 10 years later. I thought we were done with the process. Is this a function, as I believe, of the collective bargaining agreement legislating mediocrity and sort of making the good teams not as good, sans Boston, and making the bad teams not as bad, to sort of bring everybody closer to this NFL 7-9, 9-7, no great teams, no bad teams sort of league?
First of all, I just want to say, I appreciate the fact that you're still living in the world where the NFL is 16 games, because I do too. Because I just can't get behind a seven, an odd number of games in a season. It is completely and utterly outrageous to play an odd number of games.
It doesn't make sense.
How your season is a prime number is insane to me. That is insane.
That's a great point. It's a prime number too. You can't split
that
up anyway.
A prime number. It's not like a multiple of five, even 17. Are you kidding me?
It's ridiculous.
It is incensing, to be honest. But Giovanni, I have no idea what you just said to me. I don't remember. I heard 17. I heard 9-7, and I got so excited.
I was, right. I was
tanking.
I was, you know, you got
tanking.
Me
tanking. I
me.
Know now. I know. There I remember. I got so angry about the NFL schedule being seven stupid 17 games. So dumb. So dumb. It's 17 games. 9-7, 10-6. So much better. Who cares about? I'm not doing 11-6. I don't know what to make of an 11-6 record. It's just I can't deal with it. Anyway, tanking. tanking.
Tanking.
I was talking to somebody earlier in the league. I guess it was a week or two ago. And I mentioned how the Nets just look really frisky and how they must be so annoyed with how frisky they are. Because the Nets obviously, like, the Nets telegraphed their desire to tank, right? They make the trade with Houston this summer in order to get their pick back. And the only thing that makes that trade with Houston worth it is if they get a high pick out of it. If that pick ends up being 13, which I don't think it's going to be, but if that pick ends up being 13 or something like that, then that is a really bad trade for the Nets. The whole point of that trade was that they get back a really high pick and they tank. And the Nets were looking frisky. And I'm talking with somebody and I talk about how there are more teams that look frisky now than I kind of thought would look frisky. And he says to me, that's because the bad teams haven't realized they're bad yet. He says, once the bad teams realize they're bad, then they'll either start acting like bad teams or it'll just pile on for them. They'll go out there with the expectation of like, we're a bad team, and so we're supposed to lose, even subconsciously. I think that's what we're going to see. Like, I think the, let's say, Charlotte Hornets will end up getting down to that level. I think the Brooklyn Nets will end up getting down to that level. We haven't seen enough basketball yet for one of these teams, like the Nets or the Hornets or Utah or another one of these like lower groups, Toronto. One of these teams is going to lose like 14 games in a row. It's like, you know, like the Pistons. Remember last year, the Pistons started 2-1. We were all like, oh, are the Pistons decent? And then they lost 907 games in a row. We were like, oh,
I was here
they
for
are
that.
Not
I live
good.
In, I lived in, I lived in Detroit for that
I
whole
know
experience.
You did. For all 907 games.
Yes, and every last one of them.
It's like we haven't had that yet. So it will happen. Teams will turn on the tank engines. The trades will be made, especially December 15th. Like around December 15th, we're going to start to hear stuff pick up about vets on teams end up, you know, teams trying to move on from them. I think a lot of the Nets guys are going to be available. You look at them and it's like Cam Johnson's a good player. Dorian Finney-Smith's a good player. Dorian Finney-Smith's a good player on an expiring contract. He hits threes. He guards. He's plug
and
play.
Somebody for a veteran team to get. Somebody for a veteran team to pick up, baby. That's
Dorian
easy.
Finney-Smith could play for literally any team in the league, and he would make that team better. He just does all the role player stuff that you want a role player to do. He's just a good player. Dorian Finney-Smith could fit in wherever. Cam Johnson could pretty much fit in wherever too, on a slightly higher salary and longer term contract. But Cam Johnson could do that too. I think Cam Thomas is somebody that they could move on from. They didn't reach an extension with him. Like a lot of these guys on these teams are going to try to move on from them. And it's going to be harder to trade players in season now because of the CBA. And that's one of the things where like, I think in certain situations, it's going to be harder to move on from guys, which is what is going to perpetuate that parity you mentioned earlier. However, I still think we're going to see some of these teams go nuts. I mean, I think go nuts in the bad way. I also think for what it's worth that like the East is so bad that there are some teams that are like not just not going to be incentivized because they're going to be like, oh, damn. We're the Bulls, and we have a chance at the 10 spot again. We have a chance at the play-in again. Well,
the Bulls Invitational. The Bulls-Hawks Invitational. That is the play-in.
Right. The Bulls and the Hawks, like they're going to be like, oh, damn, we can go for this? Let's go for this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So if the East were in a better place, if the Spurs were still in the Eastern Conference and they were the 5 seed and knocking everybody down a peg, then maybe one of those extra teams wouldn't feel that incentive. But I think in the East, there are some of those teams that are going to feel that incentive too.
Well, I was talking to an executive not too long ago, and it's one of those surprise teams. And I was like, and I was pointing to other surprise teams. And I was like, man, that team could get to 35, 36 wins. And he looked at me like I grew 3 eyes. He said, they're absolutely not getting there because the second they get good, they're selling off those parts. They need assets. And I was like, oh, so much for thinking in the present. So much for looking at your fan base and saying, hey, maybe we get a playoff game or two out of this. Absolutely not. Now, you touched on it I think I heard my colleague Brian Windhorst touch on it from ESPN. Like, you opened the door to it. I don't say you touched on it. Where do you sit on playoff reform, scrapping the conference models and going 1 through 16? I think it's a terrible idea, but I think it's something, who knows, it might be so terrible that Adam Silver might actually listen to.
I don't love it. I don't hate it. I totally see where Wendy's coming from.
You'll never appear on this podcast again, Fred Katz. Good grief.
I unabashedly love Brian Windhorst.
No, but Wendy was saying he heard it from other executives. He wasn't touting it as his own idea.
I heard him say it. I'm just saying that I unabashedly love Brian Windhorst.
We love him here too.
He's just one of my favorites. I just think he's fantastic. So I'm just going to get behind anything with Wendy. The thing that I don't love about it is it has the same vibes to me as when they removed center from all-star voting.
Mm-hmm.
Because they said, oh, the center position's done. And then it turned out it was just a weak time for centers. Like, you look back at 2014, it's like DeAndre Jordan was first team All-NBA 2014. Oh, yeah,
Joakim Noah.
Right. Finished fourth in MVP voting in 2014.
Yep.
But like DeAndre Jordan is maybe 2015. DeAndre Jordan was first team All-NBA as just like a rim diving center. And everyone's reaction is,
get rid of the center.
Centers are done. It's the league of small ball, and we all should have listened to Mike D'Antoni, because Mike D'Antoni from the very beginning said, don't call it small ball. It's not small ball. It's skill ball. You just put in the most skilled players. And if the most skilled players are bigger, that's even better. The advantage is not that they're small. It's that they're skilled. And then what do you know? We started seeing the next evolution of all of these unbelievably skilled seven-footers, and we started seeing Joel Embiid and Karl Anthony Towns and Nikola Jokic. Do we see Joel Embiid?
Because I don't know. I mean, last I saw him, he's on the milk carton. Last I saw Joel Embiid, he was turning to Inspector Gadget and Columbo and Matlock, because he was going to go look for the leak in the locker room. Not going out and playing. He's going to look for the leak. That's the last time I saw Joel Embiid.
Well,
you said we've seen him. I just wanted to make sure that you've seen Joel Embiid on the basketball floor.
Sounds like an elite plumber to me.
I mean,
detective.
Detective, we need to get John. Can you get the Law and Order for us and just put that right there? Whenever we reference Joel Embiid, that's going to be the official sound of Joel Embiid, because he's going for the detective. He is going for who sprung the leak in the locker room. That's just great. I love it. I love whenever players do that.
Well, I'll tell you this much: I don't love when the league has a reaction to something that could be a trend, and then makes a permanent decision based on what could be a trend. And I get it. The West has been better than the East for the most part for a gazillion years.
Mm-hmm.
However, it was only like 2 years ago that we were all talking about, like, the East is back. What happened to that? I think it's kind of a nightmare from a travel standpoint.
Yes.
With the way that they play, it's just kind of a nightmare from a travel standpoint. You're going to have to make the season longer. It's not like baseball where you go to one destination and you play three games or four games in that one city. If you're going to do away with conferences, you probably have to do stuff more like where it's like a baseball series where you go there and you play two games in a row or something like that.
You have to completely unbalance the schedule if you're going to scrap conferences. And I think the Western Conference GMs, I think it is very self-serving for them to say, hey, we should do this because it's their teams that are on the outside looking in. And I get it. But if you have 15 teams in the Western Conference, Fred, and 10 teams pretty much qualify for the playoffs, I'm sorry, 82 games is enough.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
That's me. I'm an old man.
Look, ultimately, and I know the Heat made the finals as an 8 seed, and the 99 Knicks made the finals as an 8 seed. Again, ultimately, if we're just dealing with bigger picture, teams that make the finals are 1 seeds, 2 seeds, 3 seeds. Yep. That's pretty much it.
Yep.
And ultimately, that's just what's going to come out of either conference. And if you're screwed because you happen to be in the play-in, in the East, then you're probably not a finals team. If you're screwed because you happen to miss the play-in by one spot and you would have been the 5 seed in the East, which might be the case, because the Spurs are scrappy, man.
Yes, they are.
Spurs are screwing everything up for everybody. I love watching the Spurs.
I did not think they would be bad this year.
I didn't either.
And Houston. I didn't think Houston would turn it around looking like this. Like, Houston's a team that not only while they're still together, because I think they are prime candidate for, hey, unhappy, this grown-up superstar, you want to come over here? Like, I think they're prime candidates for that. But they're going to make life a living hell for all these old teams.
They are so athletic, Houston. One of like my favorite moments in all of basketball right now is just watching Amen Thompson guard an elite player. It is next level. There's so many young players now who have just entered the league ready to defend. Mm-hmm. Feels like at a disproportionate level. Like, it didn't used to be like that. I don't know why it's happened, but you look at the last few years, it's like Amen Thompson is so good defensively. This year, Steph Castle is so good defensively.
Yeah.
Last year it was Thompson. Last year it was Chet Holmgren. Last year it was Victor Wembanyama.
Yep.
It's like these dudes are normally not, even like Toumani Kamara comes in last year and does a really good job defensively for Portland. It used to be so rare. Like, the defense almost always lagged behind the offense. And you look at some of these guys, and it's like these guys are coming into the league ready to guard. And holy crap, like, Thompson is insane, man. When they go small and he's like at the five, it's ridiculous. Yeah. That team is so athletic.
No back down.
That team is so athletic. They've got size. They're competitive as hell. They fight through screens like crazy. Like, they'll be small, but they're not just going to like switch for the sake of switching. Like, they will try to fight through your screen,
yeah,
and then they'll switch if they have to switch. That team is aggressive as hell, and they are fun. Like, they are really fun to watch. They're a cocky team. That's honestly a team with Dylan Brooks' personality.
Well,
is really what it is. And I mean that in a very complimentary way.
I mean that in a very complimentary way. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is my man Fred Katz.
You're gonna get us both fired, man. Don't get fired. What was it? Jacoby used to say, Jalen Rose, don't get fired. Don't get fired.
We're not getting fired. I didn't say a thing. I don't know what you're talking about, because John deleted that from the podcast. So no one's gonna hear exactly anything that I said or that you're reacting to. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is Fred Katz. Don't forget to read him at The Athletic and also listen to his podcast, Katz and Shoot, twice a week. Thanks to producer John and the entire team who works so hard behind the scenes on this show. If you have not already, don't forget to go subscribe to The Good Word with Goodwill. Wherever you get your podcast, leave us a rating and review. We pay attention to all that stuff. Of course, we are also on YouTube. And I'm taking the rest of the week off because it's Thanksgiving and all of that good stuff. So I'll see y'all next week. Until then, everybody be safe.